This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Nearly 5 years ago, in the summer of 2009, three Americans went hiking in Iraq. Shane Bauer and Sarah Shord were living together in Syria, teaching and writing. Their friend Josh Fatal was visiting from the U.S. The three were touring a waterfall in the Kurdish highlands of Iraq, and their hike took them close to the border with Iran. As it turned out, too close.
They traveled to northern Iraq to go hiking along the Iran-Iraq border. It's a popular hiking area for the more adventurous tourists. Iranian officials say they ignored warnings as they got closer to the Iranian border. Others say they simply got lost and accidentally strayed into Iranian territory.
That's a report from ABC's Jim Shudo. Iranian authorities accused the three Americans of being spies and took them to prison in Iran, where they passed much of the time in solitary confinement. Sarah Shord was released after 14 months. The two men would remain in prison for another year. The three describe the 26-month ordeal, including their confinement in Iran's most infamous prison, in their new book, Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And we're joined now by two of them, Boston-born Joshua Fatal. Welcome to Radio Boston, Josh.
Thanks a lot.
And journalist Shane Bauer, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you.
So take us back to that moment. What happened when you were arrested? And I'll start with you, Josh.
The moment we were hiking, it was a fine day, fine July day, until we realized that we were near the Iranian border, and we didn't know it before, and that was the sort of big mistake of the hike, not knowing that we were hiking so close to the border. But when we were detained at the border by Iranian border guards, they brought us down the hill and took us to a police station, and there police officers was less interested in what we were doing or why we were there, and just started yelling about what America has done to Iranians in prison. So at that point, I realized I thought, geez, I shouldn't have anything to do with what's between the Iranian and American governments. I was just happened to be there by accident.
Yeah, and Shane, what was your reaction? What was your first feeling in that moment when you were arrested?
I was nervous, and we were insisting that they let us go back. But you know, I thought it would kind of wrap up, you know, within a day or two. I'd been at other times in the Middle East. I'd been living in the Middle East for a few years and working as a journalist. And there'd been times where I'd been briefly detained and questioned. And working as a journalist in the Middle East kind of draws suspicion. And I thought this would be one of those times when we'd just be kind of brought back to Iraq.
Yeah. When you started out this hike, was there any sense of concern that you might be sort of venturing close to danger? Either one of you?
No. I mean, we were by a popular waterfall, and then we decided to hike beyond it, yeah, not knowing that we were near the border. So really it just was a matter of like when we needed to go back to meet our friend who was still in town.
Yeah. And Iraqi Kurdistan is, you know, it's an autonomous region within Iraq. It actually has a tourist industry. There's a couple million tourists.
It's reasonably stable relative to the rest
of
Iraq.
Yeah, no American has ever been captured or injured there. Actually, in 2011, it was on the New York Times top 41 places in the world to visit.
Hmm. So you were taken to an unknown prison, separated, interrogated. So describe what those first days were like. You ended up in solitary confinement with little sense of what was going on outside of the world. Josh, what was that like?
It was scariest days of my life. I didn't know what was going to happen, where we were going. You know, they kind of shuttled us from police station to county jail. And it took a few days to get to Evin prison. And when I was there, I was blindfolded and thrown in a cell alone. I just remember walking along in prison uniform, just sitting down in the corner of my cell being like, you know, what next? I mean, I'm just going to sit here and rot.
What next? Shane, did you have any idea that this was the beginning of a 26-month ordeal?
Oh, not at all. I would have never, ever have imagined that it would have gone on that long. I remember during my first interrogation at the end, you know, they kind of asked me what I was doing in Iraq and these kind of questions. And so at the end, I kind of said, okay, so that's it, right? You know, we're moving on. And there were many interrogations to come after that. And, you know, when I started to think that I might be in there for another week. I was just outraged. How could you hold us for another week? You know. Yeah. And
when you were in there, you were accused of being spies. Did you get a sense from the people who were interrogating you, imprisoning you for all those months? Did they really believe you were spies?
No. Initially they may have, but very quickly we were interrogated for 2 months. They accessed our email accounts, everything, and at the end of those 2 months, our interrogators actually told us that we know you're not spies, but that the situation has become political and it's going to be up to, you know, the politicians in our government and your government to work it out, and you're going to have to wait.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when one of our interrogators was finished the interrogation and he was to send a report to his superiors. He brought us in and he said, look, I had a really difficult time, but I had to write in the final report, and I don't think you're spies, but I had to make decisions that were best for my country, and I interpreted that to mean that that's what we would be charged with, and indeed we were.
Mm. You were not beaten. You write about being in solitary confinement, though, which sounds like you make it very, very clear, because we use these words sometimes that solitary confinement, gee, it sounds tough, you're all by yourself and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, it's as close to torture as anything could be, isn't it? Yeah. Anyone want to describe sort of add some meat to that bone about what solitary confinement does to somebody?
It's, Martin Luther King spent 24 hours in solitary, said it was the worst day of his life. I think kind of isolating torture to physical is really limited. I mean, the way the mind just comes to became my worst enemy, and everything I wanted to do was like battling my inner demons just to get out of bed in the morning, to eat my food, to it was like how to get through. And I remember at one point, like, well, what are my options? I mean, there's nothing to do. And at one point, I looked at the laundry detergent that I was allowed to wash my clothes in and thought this would be my only way out if I swallowed enough of this stuff. But, I just felt like, okay, well, I'll just get through another day and see what happens.
Yeah.
And so much of, what we understand about ourselves as human beings comes from our interactions with others, and that you don't really realize the degree to which that is true until you're stripped away from all of that. You know, as soon as you're put in a cell alone, your mind starts to change, your thoughts slow down, and I started to feel kind of more animal almost, without conversation. I didn't have internal conversation, and I started to really hope every morning. I would spend my whole mornings just hoping that my interrogator would come so we could have an interrogation, which would mean that I would have some kind of human interaction.
Mm. You really began to look forward to the interrogation.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Well, tell me a little more about that, because you write a lot about your relationship with the prison guards. One whom you call friend takes your books away but returns them apologetically later. They don't torture you. They don't want you to starve. They need you. Tell us about that. Josh, tell us about the relationship with the guards.
I mean, it was this similar to how Shane just described it with the interrogators. You need them, and then you hate them. And my relationship with Friend, that's how he, when I asked him his name, he said, you could call me Friend. He was one of the few guards that spoke English, and he took my books one day, and that was like all I had. That was the only way to occupy some time. And so I protested that, and eventually he gave it back to me. But it was at every point with Friend, it was manipulation. And when I kept telling myself, don't be nice to him, don't be nice to him, because every time you're nice, he takes advantage. But I couldn't stop myself. I couldn't stop myself from, teaching him a little bit of English or playing some game that he wanted to play with me, and then he would take advantage of me by taking my books or something like that.
Now, you would hear people being beaten in prison. You weren't physically beaten. Why not, do you think?
There were some instances, where we were faced with violence with the guards, and the reaction to those instances was the administration kind of freaked out, because we were valuable prisoners. There was never a kind of order from the top to beat us, but sometimes guard would kind of go off the handle. Yeah. But we everybody there, we knew, the guards knew that that we were valuable, and that kind of gave us a sense of power in a way, you know, that we could kind of push the boundaries a little bit. And, you know, because ultimately Iran was using us to kind of, you know, make itself be more powerful vis-a-vis the United States. You know, they wanted to kind of get back the United States, and we had American passports, so they, you know, held on to us.
And that's, and just to jump in real quick, and that's why when the guards would be beating a prisoner and we would hear it nearby, we kind of didn't feel afraid to start pounding on the door in protest. And then the guards would come and say, well, you know, why are you pounding? Stop it. And we would say, what is this? Is this like Guantanamo? And they would get
they took
quite
that
flustered
really seriously, right? Yeah. Comparing what they were doing to what the Americans are doing in Guantanamo.
Yeah. They'd really be insulted by that. Yeah.
So after 14 months, Sarah Short, your partner, Shane, is released. And you write in the book how her departure really affected you two. And you write, something has been quickly changing in us since Sarah left. She kept us gentle, but now we are hardening. We speak to each other less, and an amorphous tension lingers in the air between us. Explain that a little bit more. What happened when Sarah left to you two?
Well, there was a process where Josh and I were put together after 4 months, and that was this kind of opening for us where we're out of solitary confinement, and it was wonderful to be in a cell with another person, to share ideas, talk about every little thing. And over time, and especially once Sarah was gone, our world just kind of shrank. You know, we went from basically a three-person world to a two-person world. Even though, you know, we would only see Sarah for an hour a day, just being in a cell 24/7 with another person got to be really difficult. You know, we had no escape from each other. By the end, we were, you know, as much as we were trying to kind of support each other, we ended up having huge discussions and arguments over, you know, where to put a plastic bottle, and would kind of tear up our whole cell to figure out whose side of whatever it was going to go on.
And, I remember wishing that a guard would come and be a jerk to us so that we could band together and argue with him, just so that the tension between us would lessen.
Yeah.
And that happened frequently enough.
Now, about a year after that, if I have the chronology right, you're tried as spies. You're sentenced to 8 years in prison. But then you were released thanks to a bail or a ransom reportedly paid by the Sultan of Oman. You're shuttled out of the country to Oman. What's going through your mind on that day when you're released, Josh?
We had inklings, but had no confirmation that was going to happen. We were in the courtyard that day running in circles, which we do for exercise, 30-foot circles, and then they, instead of taking us back to the cell, they take us to the nurse, and then take us to where some of our stuff is, and then take us home. And immediately, it was amazing to run down the steps to the arms of my family, to swim in the ocean, to sleep in sheets for the first time. But my mind was still in prison, and it took a while for me to. I would still, everything that happened to me, I would relate it to something that happened, and that would be something in prison. And I would look at Shane, and it seemed like he was going through the same thing.
Yeah, we were in a cell so long together. It was like we were almost of one mind. I remember one of the first days that we were out, we were going out to a restaurant with our families in Oman, and we borrowed some shoes from the U.S. ambassador there, some dress shoes. And I put them on and walked in the hall, and Josh and I both immediately looked up and looked at each other. And it was like that sound we both remember associated with the sound of the interrogators coming down the hall, because the guards would wear sandals, the interrogators would wear dress shoes. There were so many little things like that that just in our minds were connected to prison.
You know, your story is amazing, and what a relief, obviously, that you got out. But you know, you've had your share of critics out there who say, you know, what were you thinking hiking in this part of the world, and with all of the political prisoners in the world, did you deserve all that, you know, international attention and effort to get you out? How do you respond to those concerns? Let me start with you, Shane.
Well, I think that you know, I certainly feel like what happened to us isn't unique. It was unique in that we did have that attention, and we were fortunate in that way. But our experience is the experience of thousands and thousands of people around the world wrongfully detained. In Iran, there's at least 800 political prisoners. there's, you know, people that we have in Guantanamo Bay that haven't gone to trial for 10 years. And I think we certainly feel connected to them. I would also say that, you know, we all regret being that close to the border. We didn't know that that's where we were. But our situation was ultimately a very complex. We were in the middle of this complex political situation between the United States and Iran. And, you know, we're one of many that have been mm-hmm. stuck in that position.
Can I ask you both how you're adjusting today? I mean, obviously, very traumatic event, 26 months in a prison like that, wrongly detained. Are you still, Josh, coping with some sort of trauma today?
To some degree. Yeah. To some degree. You know, after 6 months of being out, if you would have asked me that, I would have said, no, I'm all better now. I'm so much better than I used to be, and so I'm better now. And then if looking back after a year to 6 months, I would have said, oh, my God, I was a total wreck 6 months ago. And so I think it's really the same process of that. Like right now I feel largely adjusted, and I'm quite adjusted. But I think there's, you know, there's still a darkness in there that it's taken me a while to get out. For instance, real quick, these nuclear negotiations that are going on. When I hear about them and when I follow the news, I feel this like intense feeling, and oftentimes can't sleep, just thinking, hoping that this problem that had us in prison will eventually get resolved, and these two countries will come together with a diplomatic agreement.
Mm. Shane, final question to you. You know, what do you hope comes from people who read your book and follow this amazing story?
I hope that people get an understanding of what it's like to be in prison, what it's like to be wrongfully detained. And I also hope that people kind of get a kind of a more complicated idea of not just our situation, but, you know, the Iran and, you know, the situation between the two countries.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in and talking to us today. Josh Vital, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And
thanks.
Shane Bauer, thank you.
Thank you.
Josh Vital and Shane Bauer, along with Sarah Shord, they're authors of the book Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. All three are hosting a discussion of their book at the Harvard Bookstore tonight. You can find more information at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. We've got more coming up. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.